More information about e-cigarettes.
Using mutations to predict cancer therapy response.
The utility of hemoglobin A1C in people with sickle cell.
And when kids eat medications prescribed for pets.
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed, the weekly look at the medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. Posted on February 10th, 2017, I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang, professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins, president of the Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso, where I'm also dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
Rick, let us turn right away to kudos to our longstanding friend and colleague, Tom, who's a veterinarian in Toronto and has been just hugely helpful to us over the years. As a genuflection and a thanks to him, let's turn to pediatrics, a look at medicines that are prescribed for pets and how they can impact on children.
This was an unusual study. Each year in the United States, preventable poisonings in children result in over 1 million calls to poison centers. Now, put that next to the fact that nearly two-thirds of U.S. households have pets, over 74 million owning at least one pet, and also have children in the house. How often do these two collide? Children accidentally taking medications that are prescribed for pets, and what's the outcome? To address that, the investigators did a retrospective analysis of pediatric exposures to pharmaceutical products that were intended for animal use. So from 1999 to 2013, the Central Ohio Poison Center received 1,431 calls that were related to a veterinarian pharmaceutical exposure for children less than 19 years of age. Almost 90% were in children less than 5 years of age. And oftentimes it was because they were in pill bottles that weren't childproof. But sometimes, remember, we do things like we put medications in food to get the animals to eat it. And if the kid gets there before the animal does, well, the kid has eaten the medication. Fortunately, 97% of cases, the exposure did not have long-term or lasting health results. And most of these could be managed at home.
That's good news. And I guess it just points to a lot of these same old issues we have with regard to trying to protect kids from, I'm going to call it, accidental ingestion of not just things that are intended for pets, but also for other people in the household.
Yep. And so this is a call out to the fact that we need to make sure that we have appropriate medication dispensing, good home storage practices, and that we deliver the medications properly to the pets and not to the unsuspecting children.
Okay. Let's turn from here to the Journal of the American Medical Association, and I picked this study. I picked it for a couple reasons. This is calling into question the utility of hemoglobin A1C measurement in people who have sickle cell anemia, which could, of course, potentially create clinical problems if there are already people with diabetes and sickle cell. Do we really know what's going on with them? But also the burgeoning evidence calling into question hemoglobin A1C.
It doesn't necessarily call into question the use of hemoglobin A1C, but you need to be aware of the caveats around it. We know that there are certain things that affect hemoglobin A1C levels: African ancestry, chronic kidney disease, even iron deficiency anemia. And let me take a step back when we say hemoglobin A1C levels. That is a non-enzymatic reaction that binds sugar in the bloodstream, glucose, to the hemoglobin in the red blood cells. And since red blood cells have an average lifespan of about 120 days, the amount of glucose or sugar that binds to them is reflective of what someone's serum or blood sugar is. So if you have diabetes, the higher your hemoglobin A1C. And we use that for monitoring someone's therapy. You need to be aware there are certain things that can affect it. And one of these is what's identified in this particular article, sickle cell trait. Sickle cell trait is individuals that have two genes, one with a normal hemoglobin and one with a sickle hemoglobin. That affects about 10% of African Americans and less than 1% of Caucasians. And people that have sickle cell trait, that means their red blood cells don't last quite as long. These investigators said, gosh, I wonder if that affects the hemoglobin A1C level in relationship to what the blood glucose level is. To assess that, they measured hemoglobin A1C levels in over 46 African Americans, and they paired it to what the fasting sugar level was and a glucose tolerance test. In the African Americans that had sickle cell trait, on average, hemoglobin A1C levels were lower than in those that did not have it. You just have to realize that sickle cell trait actually affects the hemoglobin A1C level. Now, how did it affect it in this population? They were 40% less likely to be diagnosed with prediabetes or diabetes for the same sugar levels, and that's where you need to frame it.
I think there's definitely a caveat there. Be aware of this. But as I suggested, I've also been hearing other criticisms of hemoglobin A1c as a good A target. When we're taking a look at different studies relative to control of blood sugar, but also even as an assessment tool, and recently heard the suggestion that fasting glucose is still better.
The value of a hemoglobin A1C is it can be measured at any time during the day when you're seeing someone in clinic, as opposed to the fasting glucose. The fasting glucose, it can vary on a day-to-day basis based upon what someone's diet was the previous day and their medications, where the hemoglobin A1C kind of gives you an average over the last 3 months. But Elizabeth, I agree with you. If you just take African Americans by themselves, in general, for the same elevated sugar in someone with diabetes, their hemoglobin A1C is going to be higher than a Caucasian's. And what that means is, if you're trying to drop them both down to the same level, you're more likely to induce hypoglycemia in African Americans than in Caucasian, and that's been shown in previous studies. But I wouldn't throw out the baby with the bathwater here. I just think you need to realize the babies may be a little bit different.
Different babies for different folks. That's a hypothesis that makes some sense to me. I think, though, I'm going to just say this, that we're going to be hearing more about this issue of hemoglobin A1C and its utility. Let us turn then to another look, and we knew this was going to happen, and I was just thinking to myself, it would be cool to do a study for how long it takes studies to start to really be apparent when new things emerge on the horizon, and I refer specifically to e-cigarettes. We're starting to see a whole lot more information and data come out about them. This week in Annals, a look at e-cigarettes, their toxicities, and actually coming up with a positive message.
This is nice because it follows up on our recent report where we looked at e-cigarettes and how they adversely affect cardiovascular risk. They elevate your heart rate, they elevate the blood pressure, and they lead to increased oxidative stress, all associated with increased risk of cardiovascular events. And your comment at the time was, gosh, I wonder how it affects carcinogen levels. Well, voila, you asked the question and the study comes out this week. What these investigators did was they looked at routine cigarettes. They looked at individuals who are using e-cigarettes and individuals using nicotine replacement therapy. Are the nicotine levels the same across all these? The answer is yes. Next question is, what were the carcinogen levels? They were almost non-detectable in people that smoked e-cigarettes or used nicotine replacement therapy. That's good news. There are people that will take both. And when they looked at those people that had dual usage, the use of nicotine replacement therapy or e-cigarettes did not lower their risk of carcinogens. These are all surrogate endpoints. What we really want to know is, over the long term, how does e-cigarettes affect somebody's health? And that's going to take longer term studies.
Exactly, and I'm sure we're going to be talking about them. I would add parenthetically that there was another report this week, I'm sure you probably saw, about a new practice among youth who use e-cigarettes known as dripping. I really love that. Where they put the liquid right onto the igniter coil of their device and they get this bigger bang for their buck. And gosh, we just don't know what the impact of that's going to be yet.
And in fact, as many as 1/4 of teenagers are now dripping.
Finally then, let us turn to the New England Journal of Medicine in myelodysplastic syndrome, a look at the constellation of mutations someone has and how that predicts how they're going to respond to therapy.
Myelodysplastic syndrome is a type of cancer where the blood cell lineage that are supposed to move from an immature form in the bone marrow to a mature form where they can go out into the bloodstream don't do that. There's an increased risk of this transforming into other cancers as well. The most definitive treatment is to treat with some chemotherapeutic agents followed by a stem cell transplantation. These investigators took over 1,500 patients that had myelodysplastic syndrome and characterized the different types of mutations and the clinical outcome to see whether these mutations could either, one, predict outcome or predict response to therapy. And you won't be surprised to know that, in fact, that's exactly what happens. For example, there's a particular mutation called P53. If you have that, your three-year survival is just 20%. So these specific mutations, aligned with some of the clinical features, can predict how people will do and what their outcome will be over the next several years.
I'm going to go out on a limb here, and I'm going to say that, as you're aware, we've talked about this before, there's a big movement in cancer to no longer characterize tumors by their tissue of origin, but rather by other characteristics that they display. I'm going to bet that in short order, we're going to start characterizing tumors based on this, on the constellation of mutations that they manifest and not by their tissue of origin.
I'd say it would be the tissue of origin. The mutations will be incredibly important, and also some of the clinical factors. You mentioned mutations. In many states, insurance companies do not cover this testing, and it could be from $1,000 to $8,000. I think the price will come down, and secondly, the insurance companies will realize this can help us administer more effective therapy with fewer complications, can lower the cost of healthcare in the long run.
Excellent news. On that note, I'm going to talk about the hemoglobin A1C and the sickle cell disease this week on the blog. That's a look at this week's medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all live well.